I'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land upon which this recording takes place, the Gubbi Gubbi people of Southeast Queensland. I honour their continuing connection to land, sea and sky, as well as their elders past, present and emerging.
Hey there, welcome back to the Men, Sex and Pleasure podcast. This is episode number 207. I'm your host, Cam Fraser. We're talking all things masculinity, sexuality, male bodies and men's experiences of pleasure. And on today's episode, I have the pleasure of chatting with Dr. Joe Milios. Joe is a physiotherapist with a special interest in men's health, yoga, and Pilates. Since establishing a men's health service in 2005, she has treated over 3,000 prostatectomy patients, over 500 chronic pelvic pain patients, and hundreds of men with erectile dysfunction. Among achievements such as delivering men's health courses to physiotherapists in Australia, England, Ireland, Portugal, New Zealand, and South Africa, Joe also established PROST, Exercise for Prostate Cancer, a not-for-profit community education and exercise program for men in 2012. She's fantastic at what she does. I've known Joe for several years and cannot recommend her highly enough. Her work is incredible. And on this particular episode, we talk about her work, as well as diving into some of the nuances around pre and post protocols for prostate surgery. For example, prostatectomy for prostate cancer patients. We talk about Kegels and reverse Kegels and pelvic floor exercises in general. We cover shockwave therapy for erectile dysfunction and some of the research that Joe has done around erections for her clients. And we round the whole conversation off with a look at the importance of having a supportive partner and focusing on intimacy and the building of a sexual relationship and what that has looked like for Joe's clients in her work. So you can find all of that amazing work that she's doing at her website, which is called menshealthphysiotherapy.com.au. Highly recommend checking it out. Big fan of Joe and her work. It was lovely to connect with her again to do this podcast. Super enjoyable for me, although I was a little bit tired. It was quite late at night for me, so hopefully that doesn't come across too much, but I will throw that in there. But it was super enjoyable to chat to Joe, and I hope you enjoy listening. And you and I can jump straight in. The way that I like to start, Joe, is with three questions. Who are you? What do? And what are you really passionate about?
Who am I? What do I do? And what am I passionate about?
That's it.
Okay. Who am I? Well, I'm a physiotherapist from Perth, Western Australia, and I have scoliosis, which is quite severe. So I used to be 5'2" and now I'm 4'10". That's been a little bit of a challenge in my life, but I will be having surgery later on this year to hopefully make me a bit taller and a bit straighter. My whole physiotherapy background really stemmed from having this scoliosis as a 12-year-old, where I had to wear a spinal brace for about 5 years. I really wanted to be a classical ballerina, but unfortunately my career path had to change because I didn't pass the medical tests in the final auditions that I went through. So about 10 years after being a musculoskeletal physio, my brother, who's a urologist, invited me to come and watch him do some surgery on a radical prostatectomy technique that he was pioneering, which was using the camera or the keyhole procedure for the first time in Western Australia. So it was just an awesome opportunity to see my brother at work. And he and I just devised a little way of helping patients going through prostate cancer, because they all end up with incontinence and erectile dysfunction. So we want to try and minimize those by combining our skills. So I basically now say I'm a men's health physiotherapist, and I've done research and a PhD and run a few community programs. I have a charity called PROST it's like an exercise program for men with prostate cancer. And apart from my work, I really enjoy doing yoga and more recently Pilates, reformer Pilates. I like to go fishing, and four-wheel driving has been a recent pursuit. I love walking my big golden retriever dog, Apollo. And I'm really just passionate about education and family life and just making sure everyone on the planet gets a fair go when it comes to health. And lately I've been doing a little bit of volunteer work with something called Homeless Healthcare in Western Australia. And that's been really, really eye-opening, just to keep me humble and keep me kind of grounded, because sometimes you get to see the best of everything and you know life's not really like that. So I'm just really passionate about the community and conversation and helping people.
Yeah, that's amazing. And thank you so much for sharing all that. It's good to get to know you a little bit more. And so I'm really grateful that you were so open about those things as well. So yeah, I'm excited to chat with you. This has kind of been a long time coming for me. I've been wanting to get you on the podcast for ages since I first met you. And you know, I'm curious, it has been about 5 years since we last spoke. And I'm wondering, have you seen any trends or any uptick in the accessibility of men's health, or like the way that it's talked about? Have you seen any changes, or I guess what I'm leaning towards here is, like, I've noticed lessened stigma when it comes to guys talking about prostate health and sexual health and reproductive health. And I'm just curious, are you noticing anything on your end?
Yeah, absolutely. When I first had a chance to work with a Queenslander by the name of Peter Dornan in 2010, and I went across from Perth to spend a week with him. And when I was over there, he introduced me to a physio by the name of Pauline Chiarelli. And she did a presentation and she said men's health is about 30 years behind women's health at that time. And I think it was true. I reckon it's now like a 10-year gap. So the gap is closing. But what I do find now is a lot of my male patients are already a bit prepared for their prostate cancer surgery. They know they have a pelvic floor. They've talked to other blokes about it. And a lot of them have got more insight as to what's coming. And they're better prepared. They're really onto their fitness. They're really open. They want to talk about their sexual function as well as their continence function. And I think campaigns like Movember have really helped soften their attitude, and probably the Me Too movement as well, because I think, you know, especially my son says this all the time, the average everyday bloke on the street is probably the most unpopular person in the world right now. So I think men are really keen to stand up for themselves a little bit more too. And I think that's a really, really good thing. So definitely changed. And yeah, I'm sure in the last 5 years since we first started talking, it's probably been the biggest growth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, beautiful. And I like that reframe there around, you know, standing up for yourself. And that makes me think of like advocating for your own health as well. And I definitely notice that when I speak to some of my clients, like they're really like, I want to know this about myself. I want to know this about my body. I want to like do something about this. And I do think that's a really good thing, is being an advocate for your health and wanting to get the best outcomes for your health as well. So that's quite a cool reframe. Yeah. So I appreciate that. And I guess like I want to dive into the nuances, get into the weeds, so to speak, of, you know, prostate health and you know, aging as well, I think is something that I don't cover enough on my podcast. Okay. I've had David Dyke, for example, on the podcast. Yep. David's amazing. I've had Mish Middleman on the podcast as well, about their experiences with prostate cancer and surgery and recovery and sexuality and intimacy. But I'd love to, obviously they're speaking from a patient perspective, and lived experience, but I'd love to speak to you about, you know, the clinical side of things and the health side of things and you know, what men can do essentially to mitigate their risk of prostate cancer, and then even, you know, what they can do if they are experiencing that and how they can still live like, you know, thriving sex lives, I suppose. So that's kind of my agenda for our chat. And I wanted to, I suppose, start with, you know, what are some of the risk factors for guys, like the guys that you work with, the guys that come and see you and that are needing help, like what are some things that are contributing to
I think one of the most important things is, first of all, to actually talk about things very simply and to educate guys in the fact that they do have a prostate. And the prostate is normally about 35 cc's to 40 cc's. But as men get older, it's a natural part of aging that it gets a little bit bigger. About 1% per year it grows in size. And a lot of men are fearful about having the prostate exams because it's the finger up the bum test, which, you know, they often feel is quite confronting. So about 5 years ago, there was a decision to try and reduce the fear around that by just suggesting that we just need to do a blood test as a first step. So that's this PSA blood test, the prostate specific antigen. The problem is that there's a lot of fear still around guys thinking that they have to go and have the the digital exam, and that's just not the case anymore. However, about 10% of all prostate cancers will be missed by the blood test and picked up by the finger up the bum test. So usually what happens if the PSA level is a little bit higher than it should be for your age, then a repeat test is done usually within 1 to 3 months. And if that PSA blood test is still of a concern, then generally a guy is referred to a urologist. The urologist then does the digital exam, and then he'll usually do an MRI. And then when they see any evidence of anything on the MRI, they'll do what they call a localized biopsy. And then not until they've actually got cells that show they have cancer in them will any surgeon even contemplate treatment. So we've got to kind of be aware that probably only about 1 in 3 of those biopsies will result in prostate cancer. But even if they pick up some abnormal cells, it's good to know many years ahead that you might need treatment one day, and you can do plenty of things to minimize the PSA speed or doubling time. But I think what's really important to also know is that there's not usually a lot of symptoms with prostate cancer in its early microscopic level. Right. And what's more common though is for men to get the aging prostate signs, like a slower flow of urine, getting up more frequently at night, having a bit of stop-start flow or dribbling a little bit. But that can often happen from the ages of 40. So for every decade, we say 40% of men at 40 and 50% of men at 50 have prostate enlargement, which can impact on their urine flow. But a similar number have signs of erectile dysfunction. It goes up 10% every decade as well. So they're just normal aging things. But it's whether or not a guy picks up there's been some changes that we want men to be more in tune with. And so it doesn't necessarily mean that there's cancer, because the prostate is more likely, in fact, in every man will get bigger, that's more likely to be a problem, the aging aspects of the border works rather than cancer itself. So I think if we just have that discussion that, hey, every man has a prostate, and B, it is going to probably cause you some problems as you get older, don't not get it checked because you're worried it's cancer, because it's more than likely not.
Mm-hmm.
And then if we have that discussion, and the campaigns like Movember are always saying, get your testicles checked, get your prostate check, and check your mental health as well. These sorts of things, the earlier we pick them up, the easier they're treated.
Yeah, thank you for speaking to that. That was kind of what I was wanting to leverage towards, was like this idea that rather than waiting for quote unquote symptoms to show and then trying to do something about it, be proactive and start to get on top of your health and do regular checks and regular checkups. I'm a big advocate for, you know, the guys that I work with, you know, checking their testicles on a regular basis. Yeah, you know, I'll give them practices to do that. I'm curious, is there ways that you can check your prostate at home without needing to go in and do a digital exam? Is there something that you can do to check if there's enlargement happening?
Really, it's just an observation of your own urine flow, because the prostate really is the gateway. I say it's like the plug that supports the bladder. Mm-hmm. And then the sphincter at the top of the bladder is called an internal sphincter. And I say that's like the seal. So in radical prostatectomy for prostate cancer, both the seal and the plug are removed. So that's why men become incontinent. So there's not really a test as such, but certainly if you just try and stop and start your flow of urine midway through doing a wee, you should be able to switch off the flow quite easily. And if you can't, it can be because the prostate's compromising the function of the pelvic floor. And it's normal for men over 40 to get up once a night to empty their bladder. But if it's something that changes, or there's any stinging or burning or any blood being passed with urine or even in semen, it's really important to go get it checked. So it's more just being aware of what's normal for you and then getting onto it sooner to ensure that little minor things like urinary tract infections are picked up, rather than panicking and not confronting it because you're worried that it's cancer.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you for speaking into that. And you mentioned an enlarged prostate as, you know, at the age of 40%, and then it increasing 10% by 10 years. And I've heard that statistic before, and I think that's an easy one to remember as well, which is great. Yeah. And is the term prostatitis to refer to an enlarged prostate, or is that different?
So there's really four main things that can go wrong with the prostate. So one of them is prostatitis, which means there's an infection in the prostate. But ironically, if they give men who have prostate pain symptoms antibiotics, thinking that it's infection, only 3% of the time does that cure the prostatitis. So there's 97% of men who don't respond to the antibiotics. And that's because they often have something called chronic pelvic pain syndrome or pudendal neuralgia, which is often an overactive pelvic floor or basically unhappy musculoskeletal system. Quite often the sacroiliac joints in the spine being a little bit compressed, often from some trauma. A lot of guys who play heavy sports like rugby and footy and lots of heavy landing, they can get a real jar in their sacroiliac joint. And then over time, it ends up impacting on the pudendal nerve that passes through the sacrum and into the pelvic floor, the bowel, the bladder, and the sexual organs. So there's a real misunderstanding about prostatitis. We now categorize it into four different types. So type 1 prostatitis is when there is an acute infection that you would get antibiotics for. Type 2 is having a chronic infection that you might need ongoing antibiotics for. And type 3 is when there's no infection, but there's all these signs of pain in the groin, in the testes, anywhere in the pelvis. And type 4 is when there's no symptoms, but it's just being picked up through routine testing. So in physiotherapy world, we see a lot of patients are suspected to have infections or prostate cancer, but they actually just have a spinal problem. Then you have prostate cancer and benign prostate enlargement being the other two.
Yeah, BPE as well. Yeah, okay, cool, yeah. Cool. Thank you for clarifying that. I have obviously read about, you know, the things that you can do to maintain and optimize your sexual, reproductive, and prostate health, such as minimizing your smoking and your drinking and all your lifestyle factors. And then something else that I came across, some very limited research, was like getting a prostate massage as well, and at-home devices and things like that. And there was obviously, the research is pretty sparse, and it'd be great to see some more research. But I'm curious to know, do you prescribe or recommend anything for guys of all ages to kind of maintain and optimize their prostate health and prostate function?
Well, it's a good question, because when I was just starting to work with my brother in 2005, it was actually a common prescription from some of the old urologists, and they used to do it as a technique, milking the prostate and prostate massage, and then it became something that was completely ruled out and disproven to be effective. So in my own experience in urology, I've never even had a urologist prescribe it, let alone do it. So it may be a reinvention that comes back in, but there's very little research on it. And I've never had to do it. I don't know a urologist who does do it. All those ones who used to do it have all retired now. So I think maybe it's certainly something that probably has a place, but I can't really comment any more on that because I just haven't had any experience with it.
What are other practices do you suggest? I mean, I know you're a fan of yoga, for example. Yeah. Do you suggest like other practices such as yoga or anything else to maintain and optimize?
Yeah. So really some of those lifestyle things you've already said. And my colleague, Craig Allingham from Brisbane, I don't know if you've ever chatted to him, but Craig's written a book called The Prostate Playbook. And he's actually written that because he is trying to avoid prostate cancer himself. So his dad passed away of advanced prostate cancer. So he was a sports physiotherapist for many years. And back in Sydney 2000, he was in charge of the Australian Olympic rowing teams, I think. Anyway, his dad wasn't very well. And at the time, he was so busy with the Olympics that he didn't get to spend as much time with his dad as he had hoped. And his dad passed away not long after. And he felt really like he had to do more and should have done more with his dad. So he changed his whole career around focus on men's health. So he gathered a whole lot of information about looking after his own prostate and put this book together to basically try and help any man who knew that there was a family history of prostate cancer to get up to speed with all the healthy things that you could do, which is reducing your alcohol, eating certain foods and vegetables and drinking lots of green tea and just doing anything you could, keeping fit and keeping your BMI under 25 if possible. lots and lots of things just to try and maximize your body's own health state rather than putting it into a state where it has to fight the prostate cancer. Because unfortunately, there's a 1 in 2 chance that if your father or brother or first line relative has prostate cancer, a 50% chance that you as the next male in the line will develop prostate cancer. So that's a really awesome resource if anyone's interested.
It's a only great resource.
$15 or $20, I think. And Craig's got a website called redsock.com. And Red Sock is REDSOK. And yeah, it's really easy to get that book. So I always have those in my physiotherapy practices, and I'm constantly handing them out to guys to pass on to other people in their family. So that I think is great for prostate health. In terms of pelvic floor health and whole body health, yes, I do try and get men to do yoga, and I have had great success in practice. Unfortunately, COVID killed off a lot of my yoga centers where I was teaching the men's yoga. And so I produced a DVD a few years ago called Yoga for Men. And that is all about letting men feel comfortable doing yoga, but not asking them to do things that they would not necessarily be able to do, like sitting on their bottoms with their legs crossed. It's just not really favorable to the male pelvis shape. So I always encourage guys not to be afraid of yoga, because it's actually physically very demanding, and they might be surprised that it's a lot harder than they expect it to be. So yoga's probably the most effective exercise for all aspects of health and disease. So I have a book called The Science of Yoga, and it talks about over 1,000 published papers on different topics where yoga was central to excellent health outcomes. So it's very underutilized.
Totally. And when I'm working with guys, I sometimes won't use the word yoga, depending on who the guy that I'm working with is. And I'll just say, they're just stretches.
Stretching,
buddy,
yeah.
We're just some stretching, man. It's good for your flexibility. It's good for your health. You know, a lot of guys that I work with are struggling with, you know, erection issues and ejaculation issues. And so one of the things I'll share with them is like the tension, the tightness that you have in and around your hips and your glutes and your pelvis and your groin is going to be contributing to those issues.
Yeah. You know? And I always say, so I had a young patient today, and he's had a problem with, he's very open about it, drug addictions. And he feels like he's completely messed up his pelvic floor because of his, you know, bad behaviors in the past. And he carries a lot of guilt and anxiety. And I said, you know, the fact that you're coming along and asking for help and trying tells me you really want to get better. And one of the things you have to do is just stop feeling so guilty and weighed down by this, because it's not letting your pelvic floor or you breathe fully. And if you're holding tension all the time, you're not going to get the flow of the bowels, the bladder, and the blood through the penis that you need to keep everything healthy. And there's a lot of anxiety and depression in our population these days, and people don't realize how much they're holding themselves so tight. The parasympathetic nervous system needs to be calmed or introduced to kind of help reverse that hypersensitivity and that locked in sensation that a lot of guys actually have. So that's where yoga, I think, can be brilliant, because it's that whole body relaxation. And a lot of it just comes from what the thoughts are in the mind. And often there's some trauma in the background that hasn't actually been addressed. And then it's bounces back in a physical way. And yoga also taught me a lot about something called the kunda, which is the bowl of the pelvis. And that kunda holds a lot of energy in terms of the sexual relations and emotions. So if the kunda is almost frozen, then it's difficult to be healthy, even for fertility, because if you have ejaculatory problems, then you can't ejaculate. This doesn't really help the human race continue. So there's so much that wraps around the pelvic floor and the prostate being healthy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really love the like holistic approach to it and the full body approach that you're prescribing as well. I like to recommend to my clients, in amongst like hip flexor stretches and things like that, perineum massage as well. And I'll give them either instructions to use their hands, but it's a little bit difficult to use your hands just by way of anatomy and having to pull certain angles. So I'll share with them, you know, some products that they, you know, can buy, like, you know, certain wands and device looking things. TheraWands, I would typically, something that I think is a little bit, what I might say, like, pleasure oriented is a stainless steel wand from Adult Toy Company. Yeah. And I like those as well because they are a toy, not like a device necessarily. Mm. And my practice is centered, my work is centered around like enhancing pleasure and having a pleasure positive approach. So I tend to incorporate, you know, the toys rather than devices. But I am a big fan of a TheraWand and would recommend it as well if people were so inclined.
It's really interesting because I've completely changed my whole approach in the last 3 or 4 years because I was invited to trial something called focal shockwave therapy. And when I actually did a presentation at the physiotherapy conference, it was 2019, and I did it on Peyronie's and how I'd done a random control trial using therapeutic ultrasound to reduce plaques for curvature of the penis. And it was actually really positive outcomes. And 70% of men got better. And usually only 30 or 40% of men get better with all the other types of treatments on offer. So I was then asked what happens to the 30% who don't get better. And I said, well, they're men who've had calcified plaques and the ultrasound cannot penetrate them. So they actually can't get better with my treatment. So they often need surgery. So this particular company approached me and said, we would love you to trial our focal shockwave therapy device, which is a German product. And we're developing protocols and we'd like to see potentially if those patients of yours that didn't respond to the ultrasound might respond to shockwave. And they said it to me in such a way that was not very appealing. They said, you can make a lot of money out of this.
Sure.
And it's a $35,000 machine and you charge $200 or $300 a treatment. And I just said, look, you're talking to the wrong person. I'm not really interested in making a whole lot of money out of these very vulnerable men. Plus, I've got a $1,500 machine that 70% of the time is helping. So I'm pretty good with that. Anyway, long story short is in the end, I decided to give it a trial and I invited quite a few of my patients, including those ones who hadn't responded to the ultrasound, to come and try this shockwave. And yes, it worked, but it actually helped the most in the chronic pelvic pain patients who had had to do internal therapies for, who'd had, you know, TheraWand treatments for years and years and years from me and me doing internal work on them. And I have not done it in the last 3 years. I've not sold a TheraWand. It's been quite remarkable. I place the shockwave therapy on the perineum and it just desensitizes the pudendal nerve. And plus they still do their stretches, but it's been a real game changer because I don't have to do any invasive therapies anymore. And just like you said, you know, it needs to have some element of pleasure. And it's really not a nice treatment to receive or even do, particularly if it's really, really painful and you're always at the risk of flaring people up. So the shockwave therapy actually penetrates up to 12 centimetres. So it's really good if there is that prostatitis type problem as well. So I've actually been invited to do a workshop on the focal shockwave at the Continence Foundation of Australia's annual conference in May in Brisbane. So I'm really looking forward to that because I think it's a bit of a game changer and its original thing was for erectile dysfunction.
I was going to say, I've just spoken to Judson Brandeis. I don't know if you know Judson, but he's a Los Angeles-based urologist and men's health specialist who's using low-intensity shockwave therapy for erectile dysfunction. And also spoke to Dr. Peter White from Bondi Medical about traction devices for Peyronie's, for example. Yep. I'm familiar with low-intensity shockwave therapy for like Peyronie's and for erectile dysfunction. I hadn't heard of it being used for like on the perineum for, you know, reducing that
pelvic pain.
Pelvic pain, and the tension and tightness there. So that's really fascinating and would love to see you in Brisbane in May. I might have to make a trip down and check it out.
Yeah, well, could certainly arrange that. One of the things that happened was I was trying to find out whether or not, because we knew that from the research that it works quite well with vascular or diabetic erectile dysfunction, but post-prostatectomy erectile dysfunction, no evidence for that when I started looking into it 4 years ago. And Then I saw that there was some research being conducted and the results haven't come out yet, but I started playing around with what would be the best patient for it. And if you select someone who's just had a radical prostatectomy, they actually have no sensation even when you put the shockwave on at the highest intensity. And if you wait till they're about 6 months post-prostatectomy, the nerve damage and the neuropraxic effect has started to dull a bit. And from 6 months onwards, I get a lot of patients getting good response. And I rarely get patients have response before 6 months. So I think when the research comes out, from what I've been able to deduce, it'll be doing it on those really early patients, and I don't think it's going to work. So it's like one of those things, pick your patient. The very first patient that I ever did the focal shockwave therapy on hadn't had an erection for 3.5 years, and within 250 shocks got an erection right in front of my eyes. And wow, he was shocked and I was shocked. But I said, oh my God, now I have to spend this $40,000 on this machine.
Yeah, that's what I have heard, is that the machines are quite expensive and that it's not comfortable as well, is that it's you know, the way it was described to me was like a lackey band being snapped on your penis, which, you know.
Yeah, and it doesn't have to be like that, because you're meant to be able to change the intensity according to the individual very subtly. Mm-hmm. And absolutely 100% of my prostate patients do not even feel it.
Oh, wow.
100% lack of sensation, but it's a once a week treatment. From 1 week to the next week, they start to get an emergence of sensation, and then they start to get erectile function. So it's so important, I think, to get your timing right. And also I teach it to a lot of people, and everyone charges around $200, $250 a session. I actually charge a lot less because I want people to be able to afford it and see a whole course through. And that way I'm learning that everyone has to be so individualized as well with it. So, but one of the most exciting things I actually discovered, and it's not even in the protocols, is that when I was trialing with these guys just to work out who it would best suit, so many of them kept saying to me, I had a little bit of incontinence still, I didn't tell you, but it's gone now. So the nerves that supply erectile function supply the sexual function, supply the bladder and the bowel function, same nerves. So now I have a whole protocol I've designed for persistent urinary leakage, and I fix it up as well quite remarkably. There's no research on that, but it's just one of those things you learn anecdotally. And I was really excited. There's a lady called Fiona Rogers in Queensland as well, all these great people in Queensland, who often sends papers to me, because there was a paper that showed that stress urinary leakage and overactive bladder in women was treated very successfully by low intensity shockwave. So once that paper came out last year, that kind of built on what I was already developing. So I do that a lot now for overactive bladder and ongoing stress urinary leakage.
And so what I'm hearing is you're not doing any of the ultrasound anymore. Is that correct?
No, I still am. What happens is if someone has a Peyronie's injury, for example, and it's very recent, they can often still have bruising and inflammation, and the shockwave would be extremely painful in that situation.
Sure.
So usually ultrasound that I do, it's a 10-minute application on quite a high dose, usually resolves the pain within 2 or 3 sessions, and then I move to the shockwave. But 9 out of 10 times these days, I'm going straight to shockwave.
Yeah, fascinating. And I that is new information to me about you and your practice, because I remember last time we spoke, you speaking about the ultrasound, and as you said, it's been about 3 years that you've switched over. So that's really fascinating and really great to know as well. I wanted to ask then about, you started talking about it, and I'd love to get a bit more into this, because I know there's a subset of the audience who would fit this demographic, but is like post prostatectomy and, you know, sexual function and you know, quality of life, I suppose, as well. And so obviously, you know, incontinence is one of it. And I like how you kind of talked about removing the plug and the seal. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really good way of like understanding like why that's kind of happening. And that's helpful for me anyway, I'll just say. And then also erectile function as well. So I guess like I'm curious what your protocols are for these guys post surgery. And you've kind of spoken a little bit about it, but I'm curious like what happens after, you know, or what happens in addition, I suppose, to the focal shockwave?
Well, most guys at the moment don't, like, I look after guys and I'm not offering the Shockwave because I don't really like to offer it until 6 months, until they've had two PSA clearances.
Okay.
So they're oncologically completely free of cancer. So it actually all starts before they even have the surgery. So my whole PhD was on pelvic floor preparation to minimize the quality of life side effects of erectile dysfunction primarily and urinary incontinence by trying to work out which protocols best fit. So what I did was I got men to do 6 sets of pelvic floor training in standing, spread out over the day, and each set had 10 rapid pelvic floor contractions and then 10 sustained ones, which were holding for 10 seconds and resting for 10 seconds. So on average, out of the 100 guys I recruited, there was a 5-week training program. Some only had 1 week, but some had 12 weeks. But on average, it was 5 weeks. And what happened was, when we looked at the sexual function outcomes, if you were doing what we called the high intensity protocol, which I just went through, from the very beginning, there was more sexual activity and more quality of life on something called the EPIC CP questionnaire. So that was from 2 weeks post-op, when that was compared to my control group that just did a very basic 3 sets of pelvic floor exercises a day based on the women's program. Mm-hmm. And that program is in all the pamphlets still. It says do 10 lifts, hold for 8 to 12 seconds, let it go, do 1 set in sitting, 1 set in lying, 1 set in standing, but no fast twitch fibers, which you need for ejaculation and orgasm. Mm-hmm. And for the reflex reaction of stress urinary leakage. So the control group only did 10 exercises in standing in a whole day, whereas the experimental group, intervention group, did 120. So there's a very big difference in the load.
Sure,
and the position. But I liken that to the whole sexual act as well, that it takes quite a lot of work and you want to build endurance and you want to build strength. And there was a previous study where I leaned a lot of my knowledge from Grace Dorey, you might have heard of, who showed in about 1995 that if men did 3 sets of pelvic floor exercises a day and they had erectile dysfunction, that 75% of them were improved or cured just by doing that basic program. But that was non-prostate cancer patients. So it was much more challenging to look at the audience that I was dealing with. So number one is the preparation. We also want men to lose 5 to 10 kilos of the gut weight, the adipose tissue, prior to surgery, because what happens is the middle ages, the tissue just embeds around the seminal vesicle, the prostate, and surgeons can't actually see the nerves. So if they get themselves lean in that pre-op phase, the surgeons have a much better chance of eyeballing or even clearing the tissue so that they can maximize their nerve sparing. Then you go to post-operative, which is really what your question was, and very few men would get erectile function within 6 months of surgery, even if all those things are done. And in my research, there was a 3-month pelvic floor intervention. So the 6 sets a day continued for the high intensity group, and just the 3 sets a day for the control group. And the outcomes for continence were such that 3 in 4 men were completely continent within 3 months of surgery wearing no pad, and 99% in the whole year in the intervention group. And when it looked at the control group, they were only getting about 1/3 as good as that. So we knew straight away that the higher intensity training in standing, which is relevant to the clinical presentations, because men usually leak when they're moving, not when they're lying down or sitting down, that was a far better program to do. So I assumed that the sexual function would show exactly the same or very similar rates of success, and I didn't show that. I showed that there was no difference between those two groups in the first 3 months of doing the trial, and I was quite disappointed in that. So that was the true erectile function scores. But when it came to quality of life, and the question is on that, they were significantly higher because these men who were drier were having sexual activity sooner and were more keen to go to the penile rehabilitation sooner. But the interesting thing was, I kept following it, and by 6 months post-op, those who did the more exercise had much better erectile function. So we were able to produce a paper that said pelvic floor exercise training should be the first step in penile rehabilitation. And that was published in the Journal of Sexual Medicine. So I'm really proud of that one.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I wanted to show that we could, any man could, if they did pelvic floor, they get a 2-for-1. They get their continence better, they get the sexual function better. And then, of course, we have all the penile rehabilitation strategies. So that's here in Perth. Most surgeons put their patients onto Cialis the day the catheter comes out. So that's a 5 milligram Cialis. At 4 weeks post-op, they usually get a vacuum pump. And they're also offered if they want to learn about using penile injections. I like to add in the shockwave once I've had the second PSA clearance. But what was really ultimately a clincher for me was that if I'd shown that my program worked better than anything else, no one would have believed me, because it takes 3 or 4 months for the neuropraxic effect to calm down from the surgery. And it, all nerve bruising and everything like that, just it's got 3 or 4 months of just not functioning. We've just got to keep the environment healthy though. So that's why I don't think shockwave, focal shockwave is going to work in the first 3 or 4 months either, but I think it will show to be working 6+ months.
Yeah, thank you so much for laying that all out and for offering the extra information about pre-surgery protocols as well. I think that's really, really fascinating and super important, and congratulations on getting that study published as well. I know it's not easy to do. I wanted to query, so there, because I know I get a lot of guys who ask me about this, so I wanted to check in with you. The pelvic floor contractions, the fast twitch, and then also the holding, is that a Kegel exercise for all intents and purposes?
So Kegel is just a man called Arnold Kegel, who was a gynecologist who designed these exercises for women to improve their sex life. And it's completely relevant. It's just that it's named after Kegel, but pelvic floor exercise and Kegels are exactly the same thing. It's just for men, there's a different focus. So if a man has urinary incontinence or sexual dysfunction, he should focus on the front urethral sphincter, the front passage, not the back passage. If he has bowel problems, you would focus on the back passage. So the anal sphincter is actually heaps bigger and stronger than the urinary one. And men have a very poor, what we call cortical map or connection between the brain and the striated urethral sphincter, the front passage, because they've got a prostate that actually automatically controls all that. So most men are really confused when I ask them to think about stopping the flow of urine. They have to do it visually. They have to stop and start the flow at the toilet. So it's really important to just make sure the anatomy is understood. And Kegel is just the most common name because it was Dr. Arnold Kegel.
Yeah, thank you for that history lesson. I get guys all the time ask me about Kegel exercises. And sometimes when I'm feeling, talkative, I'll go through a little bit of the, like, hey, this is where Kegel, the name comes from, what it really is referring to is this. But sometimes it's like, yeah, mate, that's contract your pelvic floor. Great. Yeah. And my clients, I'll obviously go a bit deeper into. And something that I do recommend to them, as you have kind of alluded to, is like, because I can speak to them online and I can say like, hey, you can do this right now. But a lot of the guys do struggle. And so I'll say like, go to the toilet, stop the flow of urine, so you get an understanding of like, pay attention to what you're doing in that moment so that you know how it feels to actually do the contraction specifically for the for the front door as opposed to the back door, let's say. And that's like what gives them the reference point for then doing it when they're not urinating, of course. Something that I want to ask you about as well, relatedly, because what I also notice is guys will go online, they'll read, do your Kegel exercises, because that's one of the most common pieces of advice that I see on all of these mainstream how to improve your sex life kind of blogs and things like that. And so I get a lot of guys come to me, they're like, yeah, man, I've been like doing my Kegels like 10 fucking times an hour, like, they're on their apps, they're timing things on their apps, and they're creating more tension, more tightness in their pelvis, right? And they go but and a lot of guys are doing it for premature ejaculation, not erection issues, which I found interesting as well. It's like I say to them like, has it gotten any better? And they're like, well, no, it's gotten worse actually, and Yeah. One of the reasons why is because they've built more tension and tightness, and they've added to the issue rather than actually making it any better. And so something that I will suggest to them is, okay, you've done all your strengthening, right? You've squeezed, you've contracted, you've built the muscle. Now it's time to relax, right? And yeah. And it's not getting weaker, it's releasing it's tension, moving. Right? Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I say to the guys, they've got to be like Jason Momoa chilling out on the couch, right? Like yeah. strong and, you know, toned and relaxed and chilled out. So I'll get them to do what is sometimes called reverse Kegel yeah. exercises, but the expanding and bearing down, and maybe bearing down is the wrong word. I try not to get them to like push to like try and, you know, make it a reverse key, which try and actively do something, but the more so like the releasing and the relaxing and the letting go. And so I'm curious to know, I went on a bit of a ramble there, I apologize, all but right. do you have guys that overdo their contractions, and do you suggest like relaxing practices yeah. for them to do?
It's a good question. About 15% of guys will get chronic pelvic pain syndrome. So that's quite high, 1 in 6 or 7. So that means that there's 10 or 15% of people who naturally have a tighter pelvic floor.
Mm-hmm.
So I see those guys come in before prostatectomy, and on ultrasound, you can see their pelvic floor doesn't move.
Mm.
And they often have pain or prostatitis, what you call hesitancy. When they try and empty their bladder when it's really full, they can't. And one of my jobs is try and teach them how to normalize the range of movement, just like if they tore a hamstring or had a knee replacement, to try and have equal bend and flex or rise and fall, contraction, relaxation, the pelvic floor. So you have to really have that baseline assessment of what each individual's pelvic floor is, their resting tone. And then from there, you've got a better idea of how to give them a protocol. So for most of my patients who need prostate cancer, that regime I talked about, 6 sets a day, is very intensive, but that's a maximum.
Mm-hmm.
If they did, so that's a total of 120. If they did 5 times that, they would be sore. They could even become incontinent, could become constipated, they could get hemorrhoids. And men often want to do things with gusto. And I tell them this has to be very gentle. Mm-hmm. So I actually get guys to just stand in front of a mirror and to relax their belly and their buttock muscles, and just to don't even worry about the breath, but just try and drop any tension out of their body. And then I just say, just very lightly squeeze the front passage as if you're stopping the flow of urine, and then gently draw the testes up or lift your nuts to your guts. And they should see visually that the testes rise and the penis retracts slightly, but it should be very subtle. They shouldn't see their shoulders or their abs or anything else move. So if you can just even start to get that focus and that non-aggressive, super gusto, super strength stuff, that's a good start. Then when it comes to if someone does truly have a hypertonic or tight pelvic floor or overactive pelvic floor, I actually say you're better off to start in a completely different position, a yoga position, like lying on your back in butterfly position with a couple of pillows under your knees, and then to just focus on breathing in and out first, just to put their hands on their belly and just notice that as they breathe in, their belly rises and their pelvic floor actually drops down, and as they breathe out, it draws back up. And if someone really struggles with this, I just ask them to put about 1/3 tension on, and I say, just breathe in, hold 1, 2, 3, and breathe out double that, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. That's how I do reverse Kegel. It's really ensuring that they're not panicking about, I think a lot of people, even physios, make it too complex by saying, breathe in, breathe out, do 30%, then bring it up to 50% and 60%. It's almost impossible, because you can't see it, you can only feel it. And if it's tight, it won't move. So it's just really important to take a lot of the fear of that, gotta do it hard, you know. So
Yeah, thank you for sharing that. There's something that I recall in my own journey, which I am interested to share with you and see what your thoughts are here. So I seriously injured my lower back when I just had, like, I won't say seriously injured, but I had like level 5 lumbar fractures, right? Stress fractures. Oh, okay. And that was when I was 15, 16 years old.
Like stress fractures?
Yeah, yeah. So, but the PARS, you know, whatever they're called. Yeah. And that was through the sport that I was doing, and I was a growing adolescent boy and things like that. But the protocol, the treatment for that was to go to Pilates, essentially, and just like strengthen my like abdominal muscles, my pelvic floor muscles, and make sure that like my back isn't bearing the load of the movements that I was doing.
Yeah.
Because I wanted to keep on moving, essentially. And one of the things that I recall doing, and this is 15 years ago now, so I'm hopefully remembering this correctly, was them putting an ultrasound on like my lower abdominal area and asking me to do like pelvic floor contractions and relaxations. And I was able to visually see on the screen in front of me like my pelvic muscles contracting and releasing, and they were like, no, you're doing it slightly wrong, like this is where you need to be going, you're doing too much in the like the anal sphincters, you need to be up here, and like they were pointing to it. So I felt like, now that I, you know, taught guys through how to do these practices, part of me is like, man, it'd be so good if we could just like get you an ultrasound and I could just be there and show you specifically what it is that you're doing. I felt very lucky that was like a visual cue for me to like really learn about my body.
That's all I do all day long. I'm just ultrasounding all day long.
Yeah, amazing. And I feel like that's such an amazing modality and tool for people to learn about like this specific practice in general.
And I do all my real-time ultrasounding in standing because I want to see what their function's like in a position of work, because that's a position they usually have dysfunction in. So most people assess people lying down, and might have really good control lying down, but
I remember being lying down when I was doing it, so that's fascinating as well, that it was that's really cool, and makes me want to like invest in an ultrasound machine off the black market or something.
Yeah, that wouldn't be too expensive. You can even get like tablets that you can put on your phone and everything these days.
Yeah, fascinating. Cool. Oh man, you're inspiring me, Joe. Thank you so much for being here. Look, I'm mindful of time. We've got about 9 or so minutes, and I wanted to make sure that there's things that we're able to cover. So what I wanted to ask you about, I suppose, is the like post-operative or post-surgery journey. You know, one of the things that I spoke to like David and Mish about, for example, was the like we spoke about sexual function and pleasure, of course, and like the communication and all the like the other elements that go into it, not just like anatomy, I suppose, but like refocusing on intimacy and pleasure, and maybe not focusing so much on having an erection and sex being so wrapped up in what the penis does and doesn't do.
Yeah.
And I think that's also, you know, really important to touch on. And I'm curious, do you do any of that? Do you encourage any of that? Do you work with guys on any of that? Do you offer them any advice around like, you know, re-engaging sexually with their partner after surgery?
Yeah. So all day, every day, basically, I'm having those conversations. And I often encourage guys to bring their partner into the appointments. Seemingly, it's more the females I find that are a bit hesitant, which has been a bit of a shock to me. Guys are really keen to know and understand. So I always say, please bring your partner in next time, because I also just want to assess how that person's relating to them too, because the median age for men with prostate cancer is 62 in Australia. So a lot of their partners, the male partners, are with women who are menopausal, and they might not have had any sexual activity or very limited for a number of years anyway. And you can pick the patient, because they straight away say, I'm not interested in sex. That finished for me a long time ago, it's okay. But what happens is once they get through the surgery and once they get their continence back, you can see that there's a yearning for just that masculine self to be functioning again. So I always say, just break this up into two things. One is about your normal physical function, well-being, and that's what we do with penile rehabilitation. And another one is your relationship and your sexual performance. And that's a long way down the track if you put it to the side. But it's far better to work on every step, you know, collaboratively. And like I found in my research, if we got men drier quicker, they wanted to explore the sexual function quicker. And that's when their partners need to be involved. So some men have like needle phobias, so their partners will do the injections for them. So that is one thing. But it's really been obvious to me. Sometimes women are really nasty. They'll say, oh, welcome to my world. I've had pads the last 40 years. You get used to it. Or don't even bother. I don't want to know about sex. They just brush the man's identity away so quickly. And I find that really hurtful, actually. And I think sometimes we as females don't, we can never know. But I mean, a man said to me today, I just feel so disconnected from myself because my penis doesn't work anymore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
One man said to me, what use am I as a man with a broken weapon? Because his penis wasn't working. And I don't think we as females appreciate how vital that organ is to a man's sense of well-being and fulfillment, even if it's the potential for it to work. If he doesn't even get sex very often or doesn't have the opportunity, it's just knowing that it can work should he want it to. So I am always trying to encourage the men to not think about having to perform and not having to think about his wife's pleasuring, but more to make sure that he's got his own function restoring first, and to play with himself and do whatever he wants for his own pleasure seeking, to know that he can have an orgasm even without erections, and to not have to get permission from anyone else to behave or help himself. So a lot of guys are like, I can't do that. I can't get a pump. I won't do that. My wife wouldn't like it. And I'm like, but it's more about your own health and your own well-being as well. And your wife might not be interested. That doesn't mean that you have to stop. You don't have to pursue anything, but you need to keep things healthy.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, a few times I've had the conversation and I get men in their 80s all the time coming in for shockwave therapy now. It's really amazing. But it's because they've met their own wife who's been married for 55 years has passed away, and they've met a younger partner who's 82. My observation is, so long as a man's heart's beating, he would like his penis to work given the opportunity.
Yeah.
So I'm always trying to just make the man own his sexuality, own his desire, no matter what age he is. And you just got to bring the woman into the conversation or the partner.
I really like how you said it's a collaborative approach, a collaborative effort. And I definitely agree with that. And that's something that I try and do with the guys that I work with as well, which is obviously slightly different context. But I always ask, I was like, does your partner know that you're talking with me? You know, if I give you partnered practices to do, is she going to be amenable to it? Are they going to be okay with me giving you something to do together? You know, are they enrolled in this journey with you? And I find, like, and I work with guys, you know, I'm upfront and say it's going to be much easier if she is or if they are. You know, I typically work with heterosexual men, so it's usually a she.
Yeah.
And, you know, I still work with guys who, you know, who see me, you know, their partners don't know, and maybe they're taking like erectile dysfunction medication, their partners don't know about that as well. And I say to them, like, look, it's, you know, we can do it and I'm happy to do it, but it's going to be like an uphill. It's going to be more uphill than it needs to be than having a partner who's supportive and on the same team.
Absolutely. And so I agree with you. I had a young guy today and I saw him for the second time today. And last week he came see me because he has a very, very minor, very, very minor penile curve and a little bit of indentation. And for 3 years, he's had this problem. And he said to me that it's affecting him so much that he can't concentrate at work anymore. And it was the most minor case of pronies I've ever seen. He'd never seen a doctor, but for 3 years, he's been researching all around the world what to do, how to get it fixed. And then he came across me in Perth. And I just said to him, well, we'll be able to help you. And he just burst into tears. And it was tears of holding everything in for 3 years. And I said, have you told your partner? Has she noticed? No. I said, I can't even notice. And I do this all day, every day. You've made it such a solo thing that you've put yourself under so much stress, so much pressure. When, if you talk to her about it, first of all, she'll be really compassionate. And second of all, she'll say, it's fine. It doesn't affect me because it's just like nowhere near as severe as most people that I see. And just the relief on that man from knowing that he was going to be okay. But I just said to him today, how are you feeling about it? He goes, I feel so much better just that I could talk to someone about it and not get laughed at. And I thought, oh, Yeah, that no one would have laughed at you, but that's just what he thought. And I said, a problem shared is a problem halved. And he was like, yeah. So I said, you just got to take that burden off yourself and share it.
Yeah, that's really lovely. And I, this is tangentially related, but something that I notice on social media is if I do a post about, Forter spots or, pearly penile papules or, curvature in the penis and, discoloration and things like that, things that are like not serious in the in terms of like you don't need to go and seek treatment for this in the terms of like a particular, medical professional. Like just like got like I get guys just flood my comments, flood my, messages and just say, dude, thank you so much. I thought I was alone. I didn't realize this was a thing. Like I've been struggling with this. Like it's been like I'm freaking out about it. And to see other guys like comment, be like, yeah, oh man, like I've seen this. Like it's just because I mean, and this is why I asked you right at the top of the podcast is like, have you seen a trend or a positive movement towards like the destigmatizing of like men's sexual health and men's sexuality and things like that? Is because like. I've seen a little bit of it, and I get to spend quite a bit of time online, so I'm kind of in some of those communities, and then also I'm reminded of like how many guys don't have those open conversations with other guys and don't have that education about their anatomy and do feel alone like this young guy who you're working with just today as well. Like it's yes, it's so important to just like have those conversations be accessible to dudes.
One of my favorite podcasts we did was our episode 7, and it was a young guy called Prince, and he was 17, and he rocked up at my door in absolute despair with a much older lady, and it turned out to be his mum, and he had Peyronie's disease he'd had for 4 years, and he was in a very dark place mentally. But he talked to his mum about it. Mum had brought him to have a consult with me, and she said, I'm just here to make sure his headspace is okay. I'm going to walk out of the room afterwards. But he and his mum did an interview with us, and it's just such a good story, because within 3 or 4 sessions, he was perfectly fine. But he thought he'd never get married, that his girlfriend would break up with him, that he never had kids, and it just needed 3 ultrasounds, and then he was fine. So he was really brave and talked about his experience with Peyronie's. And I have found that a lot of guys under 30 that I treat do talk to their mates about things. One of my young patients, who was only 20, referred to me as the penis masseur amongst his mates, and they all laughed and said, when are you going off to see that penis masseur again? And I thought it was hilarious, because just that he'd shared that conversation with his mates, and he had Peyronie's, and it was just from a sexual incident. But I was really impressed, actually. It was funny, but it was just so cool that he was sharing that.
Yeah, thank you so much for the work that you do and the space that you hold for a lot of these men. I'm really inspired by you, Joe. I think I've shared that with you
Oh, thank
enough,
you,
but
Ken.
I love the work that you do and I love the way that you do it as well. So I'm very grateful for you spending the last hour chatting with me. I'm mindful of time and I know you're going camping tomorrow and you've got
I'm going
stuff to
camping.
pack. So I'll let you continue doing that. But I'm
All
just
right.
very, very, very appreciative of you, Joe. So thank you so
That's all
much for
right. It's
speaking with
awesome
me.
work that you're doing, and I think we have to get the pendulum swinging equally between male and female and everything in between. And I'm a real advocate just to make sure men stand up for themselves too. And I can say that because I'm a female. All
That's amazing. Well, thank you so much, and I'll talk
right.
to you soon.
Thanks for reaching out. Okay,
See you,
bye.
Joe. Bye.
Yeah, bye.